Good day. We have Lauren LeCall from the Macro Butler. And how are you doing today?
I'm great, Steve. It's my pleasure to be on your show.
Yeah, great to have you. I am a big fan, a huge follower, and just love to learn from you here. And if you can share with me, as well as our listeners, first of all, a little bit about yourself. I'd love to know kind of what you drew you to macroeconomics, how you became the Macro Butler, and if you can tell us about your journey.
Well, I will turn 50 in a few weeks' time, it has been more than 27 years that I've been in financial markets. So
Yeah.
I'm originally from Belgium, and I work in asset management and private banks, first in Luxembourg, that make my journey to Asia, and I land in Singapore, where I also work for asset manager and then a multi-family office. And then it's almost 2 years ago that I decided to quit the corporate world and to create what has become the Macro Butler, because I wanted to deliver a bespoke and independent macro research, as well as bespoke advice to high net worth individual and all kind of investor.
Well, Lauren, lots going on. Love to hear your thoughts on just kind of what's going on with the dollar, first of all. If you can tell us about, de-dollarization, and if you can walk us through your thesis on what's driving it, how you see it unfolding in the next coming years.
I think that we have seen the first sign of de-dollarization with the weaponization of US dollar assets. And this mostly started after the start of the Ukraine-Russia war. So it's more than 3 years ago that for some countries, for some individuals, owning a US dollar asset has become dangerous. So after that, I guess that a lot of countries, and mostly countries in the BRICS and the Global South, have realized that their US dollar reserve were at risk. And of course, with all the wars and President Trump coming to the Oval Office in January, clearly this has kind of accelerated the trend for the BRICS, the Global South, to increasingly try to become much less dependent from the Western world in general, from the US in particular. And by that move, also much more or less dependent from US dollar. So I guess that the trend that we have seen starting more than 3 years ago now will continue to accelerate, mostly in the Global South and among the BRICS. And this comes at a time where, in fact, the BRICS countries and the Global South countries are trading more and more between each other. And since they have decided they don't need really a US dollar to trade between each other, they can trade in their local currency. In fact, there are not many reasons for these central banks of these countries to hold US dollar asset anymore. So this is a long-term process. I think that it will take at least another 5 to potentially 10 years for all this country to be fully de-dollarized. But in the meantime, and if we see a rising geopolitical tension between the West and the Global South, clearly, this will also accelerate this process. And so, what are the winner of this trend? I would say first and foremost is gold. And so, it's not surprised that we have seen a spike in the gold price since the start of the war between Ukraine and Russia, but also more recently. I mean, this has accelerated because there are increasing again tension in the Middle East. There are increasing tension in Latin America. And on top of this, there are also rising signs that Europe is on the verge of a sovereign debt crisis. So all these factors are clearly pushing the global south to de-dollarize, to reduce exposure to Western asset in general. And the only asset, first and foremost, that they can own safely at home without counterparty risk is clearly physical gold. That's why you see central bank in the global south, in the BRICS, rising their exposure to gold. The second winner of this trend, and this will probably come only in the second phase of the de-dollarization, is what is still called a local currency emerging market bonds. Because I want to highlight this, because since countries among the global south are trading more and more between each other in their local currency. In fact, if I take the example of India buying Russian oil and paying in Indian rupee, Russian counterparty owns Indian rupee. So the Russian central bank or the Gazprom of this world need to reinvest this Indian rupee one way or the other. And if they want to keep their Indian rupee, in fact, the only asset that can, they can potentially buy is Indian bonds denominated in Indian rupee. So I think that what we will see, but this is not for now, but this is more towards the end of this de-dollarization trend, we will see yields in emerging market local currency bonds trading below the yields that we can see in the Western world, can be in euro or even in US dollar at some point. But why I think that this will take some time to happen is first that the current environment, the global environment, is not really favorable for holding bonds in general. So I think that, I mean, we are not yet at that phase of the de-dollarization. And then second, what investor must remember is that during the pre-COVID and the COVID time, so here I go back to the 2020, 2021 time. In fact, a lot of corporates, including in emerging market, took issued bonds in US dollar. So these corporates still have to reimburse these bonds issued in 2020, 2021. And these bonds are denominated in US dollar, but the issue that the corporates in the emerging market or in the global south have nowadays is that since they sell their goods in local currency, they don't really get US dollar on their bank account when they sell, let's say, if BYD sell cars to Thailand, most likely Thailand will pay in Thai baht. But if BYD needs still have issued the bonds in US dollar, it will have to convert back this Thai baht into US dollar to reimburse or to service the debt issued in US dollar in the early 2020s. And so I think that there's something important here happening. And I think that a lot of investors don't really understand this mechanism is that while gold is making new all-time highs almost every day, in fact, we are likely to see a strengthening dollar against all other fiat currency because especially in the global south, there's kind of a shortage of US dollar to reimburse the debt taken earlier this decade. And on top of this, we all know, and I come back to the issue of sovereign debt that we can see nowadays in France, but also potentially in Germany, as well in the UK. So a lot of investors are clearly trying to exit the Eurozone or the European area. And these Western investors have little alternative. I mean, they can buy some physical gold as well. But I mean, if you are a Western investor, it's not really safe geopolitically to invest in the global south neither. So they will probably use this asset and go to the US. So that's why I think that in the next 12 to 24 months, I won't be surprised to see gold much higher in all fiat currencies. But also, I won't be surprised to see the US dollar much higher against all other fiat currencies. Maybe I stop there because I unpack quite a lot in a few minutes.
Yeah, so you see gold more than likely rising, and you see the US dollar being strengthened over the other fiat currencies. Can you expound on that and just kind of what does that look like for what's the dollar feel like? Are we looking at inflation? Are we looking at stagflation? Or what's kind of down the road in the next 12, 24 months?
I think that if you ask me about my economic scenario, the world is heading into a stagflation, in a global stagflation. It's what I call, in fact, the Trump stagflation. Most likely, Europe will be the worst hit by this stagflation. But the US is also unlikely to escape the global stagflation. I mean, in terms of the way that I look at the economic environment, in fact, I look at the economic environment through the lens of the business cycle. So there are the four seasons of the business cycle. So currently, I would say that the US and the Eurozone are still in what I call an inflationary boom, meaning that the economy is still booming in a way that I use a market indicator, which is in fact for the US, the S&P to oil ratio, and its position against the 7-year moving average. So until the S&P to oil ratio is above the 7-year moving average, the US economy is in a boom. So the trigger, especially for the US economy to move into a bust, would be that we see much higher oil price. And in fact, I'm going to write a special newsletter this weekend about oil. And we all know that oil, most of the price is driven by supply shock, which are related to geopolitical events. So that's why I think that for all investors, it's very important to keep monitoring the situation in the Middle East, the situation between Ukraine and Russia, potentially the situation as well in Venezuela, because a lot of people have forgotten that Venezuela is a major oil producer. It has one of the largest world oil reserves on Earth. And most of Venezuelan oil today is moving to China. So once again, would President Trump start a war against Venezuela to try a regime change in Venezuela? I mean, this would be, in fact, another proxy war between the West, the US, and the global South, because clearly, I mean, Venezuela has survived economically thanks to Russia as well as China over the past decade. So I think that to come back to the business cycle, it's very important to monitor the evolution of the oil price. So for now, the oil price is still relatively low. It's mostly because demand has been very weak. I mean, we all know that the global demand of oil has been relatively weak. Economy is also not, I would say, great unless you work for AI company or hyperscaler. So I think that this is a reason. But as I said, coming back to the business cycle, we are still in an inflationary boom. And I say we are in an inflationary environment. Again, here, I'm not looking at government data like the CPI, but I'm looking at market data and to see if an economy is in an inflationary or deflationary environment. In fact, I look at the ratio of gold to bond. And if this gold to bond ratio is above the 7-year moving average, It means that the currency of the country is not a good way to preserve wealth. And so I assume that in this scenario, the country is in an inflationary environment. So almost all countries in the world have been in an inflationary environment since the start of this decade. We all know that inflation first came because of the supply chain issue related to COVID. But they have not gone away because, again, we have seen this fact that, in fact, most of currencies or the bond market of most of the countries on earth are not a good way for investors to preserve their wealth, and they are much better to be invested in gold rather than in bonds. And then, in fact, I look at a third ratio, which is usually giving kind of the canary in the coal mine of the business cycle. And this ratio is the S&P to gold ratio. And once again, I look at the position of the S&P to gold ratio versus the 7-year moving average. And believe it or not, but on January 20, when President Trump entered the Oval Office, in fact, this is the day that the S&P to gold ratio broke below the 7-year moving average. And since then, of course, gold has outperformed massively the S&P 500. And so we can say that even that we see a bull market in terms of, I mean, in dollar terms for US equities or in euro terms for European equities or in Japanese yen terms for Japanese equities. In fact, if we measure the performance of all these indices in gold terms, in fact, the bear market already started a while ago and accelerated at the start of this year. So the conclusion that I draw is that, as I said, if I take the example of the US is still in an inflationary boom, but there are increasing signs that it's moving towards an inflationary bust. And an inflationary bust is kind of a nice way to describe a stagflation. And again, what could be trigger?
If I...
Yes, go ahead.
So go ahead. You were saying something. What could trigger?
Yeah, so what would be the trigger for the US to move in the stagflation and for the rest of the world to move in the stagflation? It's not, I mean, the tariffs are contributing to this, but I think that the main trigger to shift into a stagflation would be a sharp increase in the oil price that would come from a geopolitical shock. So I don't know if this geopolitical shock will happen in the Middle East again. I don't know if this geopolitical shock will happen in Russia or it will happen in Venezuela. But I would say that every investor should really look over the next few weeks and months what could be the trigger for the oil price to spike, let's say, to $90 or above. And this would clearly push the world into a global stagflation. Some countries will be more affected than others. So I would think that Europe, because Europe is a major energy importer, will be the first victim of this oil shock. The US will also be impacted. Asia, a lot of countries in Asia would be also impacted by this oil shock. So this is what I think that investors should have focus over the next few weeks and months. And I don't think, in fact, that the financial news mass media are really pointing to this because, I mean, they are still focusing on the latest GPU from NVIDIA. I would say that if we have an oil shock, In fact, this also could be the start of a big rotation among equities inside the equity market, meaning that investors are still widely overweight into IT stocks and AI related stocks, and widely underweight in what I call energy producers. So this is mostly the oil and gas sector. I mean, I was doing some research earlier today. The oil and gas sector in the MSCI world nowadays is 3% of the MSCI world. So it's ridiculously low for anyone who has an index allocation. And this is clearly where the opportunities lies ahead. But I would also say that if we have this oil shock, most likely we will also see a boom in terms of commodity prices. And here I'm not talking about precious metal, but I'm talking more in terms of base metal and also at the end also in terms of agriculture commodities. So also a sector that is completely out of the radar of most investors. I mean, outside copper, which has been on the focus of some investor because they suddenly realize that for AI to grow, they will need some copper. In fact, I think there are a lot of opportunities in base metals like nickel, even iron ore, and tin and other base metals, which are completely out of the scope of investment of most investors, as well as still at very depressed prices. If I look at the price of nickel, for example, I mean, the price of nickel has barely moved over the past 3 years. And so I expect that we will see the next wave of the commodity boom will probably come in base metal and ultimately as well in agriculture commodities, because also the price of these commodities could be impacted by the geopolitical situation.
So right now, a lot of people are looking at, you know, different numbers. You're saying that not many people are looking at the oil as a big trigger. Why are people not looking more at oil, and what are they? Why are they getting distracted, or why are they not seeing what you're seeing?
Well, I think that investors have been used to see oil price stuck between 60 and $70 per barrel.
Yeah,
they've been used to listen to the mass media and believe that OPEC can always increase production if the price is going up. I mean, OPEC spare capacity are very limited in the end of a few countries. In fact, on last Friday, Fitch made a review on the rating of Saudi Arabia, and they highlighted that giving the level of social spending and as well all the spending related to all non-oil investment of Saudi Arabia over the next few years, at the current oil price, Saudi Arabia could face a downgrade by Fitch. So I think that, I mean, not a lot of countries or people are really happy with the current price of oil. Of course, as I said previously, there's a lot of geopolitical impact and noises in the price of oil. But I think that at some point, even Saudi Arabia, which has been a good boy to the US empire, has its own interests at heart. And so we'll need, at the end of the day, to take some measure to see higher prices. But I would say that Saudi Arabia probably will keep oil flowing as much as it can. But I think that the risks are more on a supply shock coming from a geopolitical event in the next few weeks. And as I highlighted, Venezuela, Iran, or even Russia? Would Ukraine eat Russian oil fields deep inside Russia or even potentially in Siberia? This would clearly have a major impact on the oil price because Russia has remained a major exporter of oil and mostly to China and India.
Speaking of Russia, China, and India, if you can tell me kind of what's going on in terms of, are there gravitational shifts in global finance? We've been talking about China rising for a while. Where's Hong Kong in this? Where's the Middle East? Where's Russia, India? Where are we headed?
Well, I think that a few weeks ago we had the Tianjin meeting of the SCO, which was also under not covered properly by the Western media, but in fact was a very important meeting. So the SCO is another organization where countries from the global south, mostly Asian countries, are meeting. So initially, this organization was more focused on defense and security, but the clearly the attention and the focus of the SCO has moved also on economics. And during that meeting in Tianjin, there was a big announcement. In fact, the pipeline from Siberia to China was kind of announced. So China and Russia have decided to build a pipeline from Siberia to supply China via pipeline with oil and gas. So originally, if we look a decade ago, in fact, this project was supposed to supply European countries via the now destroyed Nord Stream. So clearly, this show that in fact, Russia, China, and also India are working together closely. And I mean, I can understand, and I will explain why it makes a lot of sense for these three countries to work together. Russia has abundant supply of cheap commodities. China, whatever anyone can hear in the Western media, is the state-of-the-art manufacturer of the world. And finally, India is probably the only country on earth with a booming consumer population. And so, if you combine cheap access to natural resources from Russia with state-of-the-art manufacturing from China, and you can sell all this to the booming Indian consumer, clearly you have the new axis of economic growth of the next decade. And I mean, these countries geopolitically have been, in fact, in wars or in proxy wars over many decades. But what the Western world managed to do is to unify these three countries, Russia, China, and India. So I can think that in this environment, and if we agree that these three countries will become kind of the new triumvirate of economic growth by the next decade, I mean, these three countries will clearly need a financial center. And I mean, from what I can see and my experience in Asia, I would think that Hong Kong should emerge as this financial center. The reason is that Hong Kong is still a relatively English city. I mean, it's not long ago that China took over Hong Kong. Most of the educated people working in Hong Kong are still, are in fact, bilingual, Mandarin and English. Hong Kong has a long tradition of being a banking center, was a regional banking center. And so I could imagine that in my scenario, Hong Kong replaced New York. Let's say after 2032, here I'm not giving us a precise date, but I expect that the epicenter of the world economy by the start of the next decade would have shifted around these three countries, Russia, China, India. And so, I mean, once this has happened, I would think that Hong Kong would replace New York after 2032. Why I think Hong Kong rather than Shanghai? I mean, it's still open. I would say answer, but as I said, I think that Hong Kong is still nowadays the place where the Western world, the Southeast Asian countries, and China can meet for business. So I would think that Hong Kong is relatively better position than Shanghai. Also, I think that we cannot forget, in fact, many people forget that the Hong Kong dollar is still pegged to the US dollar. The HKMA, which is the Hong Kong Central Bank, which is the regulator of the Hong Kong dollar, in fact, holds more than half of a trillion US dollar of reserves. So this also could be a reason why, and I come back to what I discussed before, for all these companies that are now short of US dollar to reimburse their US dollar bonds and which want to issue local currency bonds, in fact, they could easily go to the HKMA one way or the other, and the HKMA could provide some US dollar liquidity to companies which would be banned by the US and by the Western world to buy US dollar on the foreign market. So I can see that the HKMA and Hong Kong could play, in fact, the final role in the de-dollarization of the world, meaning that that would be a way for Hong Kong and at the end of the day, China to get rid of all this US dollar it still has in reserve in Hong Kong, and a way to help companies in the global south, which would be banned to buy or to acquire US dollar on international markets. I mean, some may find this a bit far-fetched, but I think that if we are going into a world which is increasingly polarized, in fact, the US dollar is going to become a weapon of mass destruction in terms of financial mass destruction. So it could be used by the US to, in fact, try to destabilize economies in the global south or in the BRICS. And that's why that, in fact, China, because it still has a lot of US dollar reserve, could kind of play the role of the IMF, the role that the IMF played during the Asian financial crisis. I don't think that any countries in Southeast Asia wants to deal with the IMF anymore, and they are more keen, in fact, to deal with the Chinese regulator because, again, China can also bring infrastructure to their countries, can bring manufacturing capabilities. I'm taking the example of Thailand nowadays. I mean, BYD has been massively investing in Thailand. I mean, Thailand during the 1980s became the epicenter of the Japanese OEM in Asia, outside Japan. And nowadays, in fact, the Chinese auto manufacturers under the lead of BYD are replacing the Toyota and the Honda of this world in Thailand. So clearly, this is why I take the example that there's a lot of, I would say, appeal for Thai companies which could be in trouble of collecting a US dollar to go and see the HKMA or to go and see the Chinese regulator. and to try to borrow US dollar from these Chinese regulators rather than to go to the IMF if they would be banned to acquire US dollar by the US government, which I think is not so far-fetched than many may think, because you can see that, I mean, the US has used the US dollar as a weapon against Iran. The US has used the US dollar as a weapon against Russia. The US has used the US dollar as a weapon against Venezuela. So clearly these countries, which are, if they are in need of dollars at some point, may not go to the IMF like France, but they may go to the Chinese regulator and get some US dollar. But I would say that for the time being, in fact, such a scenario is kind of an Armageddon scenario for Southeast Asia. In fact, in Southeast Asia, growth is not spectacular, but I would say that the economies of Southeast Asia are doing relatively well, because they are still benefiting from the expansion of China and Chinese manufacturer in the region.
So, yeah, we see the weaponization of the dollar. You use the phrase, the financial weapon of mass destruction. And you see, you know, the tariffs, you know, being used in that way as well. You see that the U.S. dollar has been weaponized in so many different ways, and countries are going, that's enough. And so it just further accelerates the de-dollarization. If you can help me, you know, paint a picture of what's next, along with the what you said earlier about the U.S. dollar being better than the other fiat currencies, how do you, if you can help me put those pieces together, like, how is the U.S. dollar better than the fiat currencies? And then we see the weaponization and constant de-dollarization. How do you help me understand?
Well, I think I can summarize is because why I see the dollar appreciating against most fiat currencies in the first place is, I mean, in a world of uncertainty, many people, many investors, especially in the West, are still going back to the US dollar. Second, I think that the issue that many BRICS countries or global South countries will have, as I said, is that they are not generating US dollar anymore, because when they trade between each other, they generate rupee, rupiah, Malaysian ringgit, Thai baht, Chinese yuan, and so on and so on. So there's kind of a lack of US dollar inside the BRICS countries or the global South. And they, I mean, as I said, these companies, even countries, issued massive debt at the start of this decade. And most of them, they issue in US dollar, because at that time, US dollar interest rate was at zero. So they issue at cheap US dollar rate. So they need US dollar to reimburse and service their debt. So, I explained that in the first phase, we have a rising dollars against fiat currencies. In fact, the rising dollars of the fiat currency would be the last nail in the coffin of the US dollar as the hegemonic fiat currencies of the world, because this will also mark the end of the US imperialistic agenda or the US empire. I think that, we could discuss another hour about US the nation versus US the empire, but I would think that given the fundamentals of the US, and because the current administration has decided to impose tariff. In fact, by imposing tariff, this was the first step of the end of the US empire, meaning that imposing tariff and not allowing a global source manufacturer to invest safely into the US. In fact, the US has put the first step of the end of the US as an empire, because if you are a Chinese manufacturer, you would rather try to sell in Thailand or even in Angola or in Peru rather than to sell in the US. So what I think we are going to see over the next few years, and this will take years, is that most global South countries will reduce their exports to the US. So the US has two choices, is to remanufacture. I mean, this is a long and painful process, because the US economy is not down nowadays for manufacturing. So if I always say, if I was the US president, and I don't look to apply for this job, but if I was US president, in fact, what I would do is I would first focus on domestic infrastructure. The US is in bad needs of improving its infrastructure. I invite all listeners and viewers to go to YouTube and to search for China infrastructure. And they will be probably in a phantasmagorical state, seeing what the Chinese can do in terms of bridges, airport, bullet train, and so on and so on. So, I invite really a US listener to pressure their own congressmen. What first the US need is improving infrastructure. Second, what the US president should do is a reform of the educational system, and to push Americans learn jobs related to the manufacturing industry. The US is in bad needs of engineers. The US is in bad needs of electricians. And today, if you are not agreeable to use immigration to attract these talents from around the world, you need to educate the young Americans. And unfortunately for the US, education takes 3 to 5 years to make a good electrician. I think you need at least 3 to 5 years of a good background. Engineers also takes 3 to 5 years. So, in fact, I think that the mistake that President Trump did in January, if he was, and since he's really focused on tariff, if he wants to go on with the tariff, in fact, he needs to improve the infrastructure of the country, and he needs to reform the education system. It will take a long time, as I said. You don't build a bridge or a new airport or a new bullet train in a few weeks' time. And so I would have expected that the current administration would have decided to take this pass. It didn't, and I think it was one of its mistakes. And the second mistake that he made, in fact, didn't create the right legal environment for Chinese manufacturer to come to Detroit or to come to Chicago and to build manufacturing plant in the US. So far, because the US and China are still, I would say, in a trade fight or trade fight. In fact, we have not seen BYD, we have not seen Xiaomi, we have not seen any Chinese manufacturer coming to the US and committing to multi-million or billion dollars investment in terms of manufacturing. And until this is not done, I mean, unfortunately for the US, in fact, the remanufacturing of the US will not be a success because you cannot remanufacture your economy without the help of China, which I said is the state of the art manufacturer of the world. So, I mean, it's not a few million dollars from a South Korean investor, which also are, I mean, not so keen to invest anymore. We have seen what happened at the with Hyundai workers. So I guess that what President Trump needs to do is to create the legal framework and establish a rule of law for foreign investor to commit multi-million or billion-dollar manufacturing investment. Until this is not done, unfortunately for the US, I mean, maybe good for the US government that will collect tariff. But until this is not done, in fact, the end goal of the tariff policy, which is the remanufacturing of the US economy, will not be achieved.
Lauren for president.
No, I'm not qualified. I don't want this job. I'm here just to highlight what American investor, American citizen should pressure their own politician to do. I think that I see the world from outside. I see the US from outside. So probably I'm not partisan. I'm not blue. I'm not red. I'm trying to see all. The US, which is a country which is blessed with natural resources, which is blessed with a big piece of land, and in fact, which is protected by two beautiful oceans, like President Trump liked to say. In fact, the US could be very successful if the US wants to become a nation rather than an empire.
Lauren for president. Hashtag Lauren for president. You heard it here first on the Steve Yang Show, Natural Resource Stocks. Lauren, if you can tell us about how people can follow you, if you can tell us about the Macro Butler a little bit and kind of what that's about and how people can learn more about what you provide.
Well, so I write a Substack called The Macro Butler. I will be launching a website in January, themacrobutler.com. So in terms of service, I have a free newsletter on Substack. Coming January, I will launch a pay subscription for what I call a monthly financial meditation. So this will be a monthly paper that take a step back on different financial thematic. I'm also looking to launch a financial academy next year. I think that I want to promote financial literacy among children and among adult learners. And then finally, I advise high net worth individual who are interested by a bespoke and independent service. Everyone can contact me at info at themacrobutler.com. I reply to all the emails, even the unfriendly emails. And also, I have launched over the past few weeks, I've launched a Telegram channel where I put, I would say, much more direct and hot comments on the topics of the day. I try to put at least two or three posts every day on any news that can emerge in this crazy world.
Crazy times. Laurent, thank you so much for offering your insight. Looking forward to continuing to follow you and learning from you. Hope to have you on the show again.
Well, it would be my pleasure, Steve, and hope to see you soon. And thank you for all your listeners to listen.
All right, thank you, Lauren. Lauren LeCoe from the Macro Butler. Thanks so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you.